Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, just the facts. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, silliness, battles against derp, stupid stuff, yeah, things. Facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening, Jack.
Woo!
Woo?
I don't know. I don't have a catchphrase yet. We barely got the nickname set aside. I haven't figured out a catchphrase.
Yeah, so we're running a little late today, just because there was a basketball game and people care about that here, I guess. I don't know. So quick shout out to Garrett, who turned 7 this last week. I believe Garrett is our youngest fan, so happy birthday, Garrett. We're gonna be joined by Dr. William April in just 1 second. Quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s, ARs, and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC, quick-detached side-saddle shell carrier. Available for pre-order, check out the new rigid interchangeable side-saddle carrier, changing how you look at shotguns forever. Find out why Steve Fisher, Chris Fry, and myself all call it the best hard-mount side-saddle carrier ever invented. Would you like to know more? Visit AridusIndustries.com. So, without further ado, Dr. William April. Hey, man, how's it going?
Very well, John. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Sorry for the late start. So, we're gonna try and get caught up here. So, this will be a quick segment, and then we'll jump right into the meat of the show. For those that have not listened to, like, the last 10 million times that you've been on the show, can you go over your background real quick?
I'm not sure it's been exactly 10 million, but something like that. I'm a mid-career mental health professional right now. I work in New Orleans, Louisiana, doing really two things professionally. The first is a private practice in mental health, and the second is I teach defensive citizens mostly on the mindset side of the house. I started training seriously in 1990, teaching in about 2000, and I've been practicing mental health for about 20 years now.
Okay. So I guess the number one, there's a couple different things that we want to talk about, but the number one thing that I am curious about that I don't think maybe enough people really consider is what they're prepared to do violence towards someone else over. And there's a lot of, like, cookie-cutter scenarios. But just, like, in a minute or two, can you sort of highlight what the problems are with thinking about it in, like, black and white terms, and then we'll pop into the break and get more into it next segment?
Sure. I think of it as an offshoot of a mental construct called projection, where people tend to ascribe their values onto the environment. And what you see in projection specifically related to what you were talking about is that people have in their minds the amount of violence that's going to be necessary to solve the problem. And they generally, it's an amount that they can cope with, an amount they can see themselves doing. Now, the problem is the world doesn't follow our preset rules. The amount of violence that we're comfortable doing may not be anywhere near enough to solve our problem. And the amount necessary to solve our problem may be an amount we're not comfortable with at all.
Now, is that set for each individual based off of any particular thing, or is it a mutable concept depending on maybe even who the attack is directed towards?
I would think the baseline is very individual, but it can certainly be trained to where it needs to be. I had a patient who was a police officer on the Atlantic Seaboard who wound up in a hand-to-hand confrontation once his gun was drawn, lost his gun, and wound up having to beat a subject to death with a handheld radio. And so, you know, when you think about beating someone to death, you're literally talking about hitting their head with something hard enough to break it open.
Right.
And that may not at all be something that people have contemplated doing, especially because the gun tends to frame things in our mind as being gun problems. And for most of us, that's a very antiseptic, you know, draw and fire and reholster because we're used to shooting at targets.
Well, and that seems to be one of the most common things that you see at something like Craig Douglas's ECQC class, where you've got gun people that are very gun-centric and have focused most of their efforts on that. And then we find out that, you know, the firearm is not what always fixes the problem. In fact, it can make it worse sometimes, depending on the situation.
Sure, it's not always an advantage.
Right.
And in extreme close quarters context, it's very far from an advantage. It's often a deterrent and sort of a trap that it's easy to fall into, sort of like the old 70s sociological notion that the trigger pulls the finger. The notion here would be that I'm carrying a gun, so my problems will be gun problems.
Right.
And you know that's true in an uncertain number of occasions.
The blade itself incites to deeds of violence. That's something like that. Let's do this, man. We have got to go to break. We are talking with Dr. William April, and right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Darkstar Gear. Whether you know the color of the boathouse at Hereford or only know the color of your mom's basement and Cheeto-stained socks, Darkstar Gear has a solution to your gear-carrying needs. Check out their clip-on holster for small semi-autos and revolvers, or their highly adjustable full-size AIWB holster. They even have a belt-wrap sheath for popular fixed-blade centerline knives. Really ties your EDC together, like that one rug I used to have. Designed, developed, and pressure-tested for real life, not Instagram. I have an Instagram profile. Follow me, Ballistic J. Find out more at darkstargear.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC, Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier. Available now for pre-order. Would you like to know more? Visit AridusIndustries.com. So we are talking with Dr. William April about violent-y goodness and violent-y badness stuff. Something,
well,
Jack?
I mean, it's all in how you look at it.
I feel like dropping a Fiona Apple, like, Easter egg here. So is everything? No? Paper bag? Come on. William, are you still there?
I sure am.
I'm sorry for making you listen to us be silly. So, we were
That's all right. I just go to my happy place when y'all start.
Yeah, just slide. See, now Fight Club. Fiona Apple and Fight Club.
That's a good combo. Moody teenagers. That's that combo right there.
Marla. So the nice thing is we're now running on schedule since we took a really short break and everything, so we can slow down just a little bit. Now, before the break, you were talking about people not being prepared to, you know, do the level of violence necessary to solve the problem sometimes, or at least not even comprehending what that may or may not be. You mentioned training. What does training, how do we get over that via training?
Well, one of the most direct ways is the use of reactive targets. Ordinarily, when you shoot a paper target, you sort of conclude a string of fire based on what you expect to do or what's called for by the string of fire, and then you look and see the results. Well, reactive targets only work if you hit them right, and sometimes hitting them right is unknown to you, and that's particularly good training.
Right.
Just shooting at a target and feeling like you got a pretty good hit is one thing, but shooting at it until it falls over or goes away or anything like that is much better because it more closely simulates what's going to happen in an encounter with another person. I had a trauma surgeon tell me that the most common response to being shot with a handgun is no response at all. So there's no indication whether your hits were good enough.
Right.
So reactive targets can teach us to ingrain the use of follow-through and, continued good quality hits until we get the result we're after, not until some kind of course of fire is finished.
So would you say that the number one, I mean, when you really see this in practice is when, you know, you catch a news headline or something about that, you know, police have shot someone umpteen number of times, and that seems excessive to people that don't know anything about this, but, you know, to you or I or anyone else, it's like, oh yeah, a cop shoots someone, you know, 22 times. It takes that sometimes.
Yeah, and it's very rarely, if you look at the cases, it's very rarely 22 high torso hits.
Right.
They tend to be, you know, hits from oblique angles, hits to extremities, hits jerked low and left or low and right, you know, sort of randomly distributed from the ankles to the forehead. but very few of them in areas where they'll do enough damage to make the person stop doing whatever they were doing to get themselves shot in the first place.
You're saying we need to hit, like, really small targets under pressure really fast multiple times?
As Tom Gibbons always said, you'll be able to deliver good hits quickly, not just make the gun go off within certain time constraints.
Right, right. Well, do you think that falls back into people don't like thinking about their magic talisman being ineffective?
I think of it a little bit from the other side of the equation, which is that people don't want to think about the true nature of the people that would force us to shoot them. The true nature of folks that force us to shoot them is, by its very nature, unreasonable. They're going to be more on the unhinged side than the normal side, and the notion that their responses are going to be what we'd expect are a little fanciful, but it's very tough to think about things that are not going to go well for us and that could cost us our lives.
Right.
It's just very difficult for people to think, you know, on the dark side of the ledger, so to speak, and yet it's something that we really have to do. We have to understand the world as it is and the nature of the problem.
Well, and that was something that when we had Caleb Causey on, we were talking about, and he made the point, you know, no one wants to think about medical training because that acknowledges that we fail, that we need medical training because we got hurt. No one wants to think about that.
Sure. You know, it's a really, you know, because we run up against the forces of people's own denial. We don't like to think about things going poorly for us. And in Caleb's class, you know, one of the greatest illuminating points that he ever made for me is, you know, one of the most important gunshot range, you know, casualty care techniques is used on yourself.
Right.
And Caleb said, if you shoot yourself, it still counts. Which is a great way of looking at it, but it means that something's gone dreadfully, dreadfully wrong in our shooting, and that's something that runs right up against people's denial. You know, I've been shooting guns my whole life. I'm not going to shoot myself. Well, until you have. You know, somebody with me is going to shoot themselves, or I'm going to shoot someone inadvertently. Preparing for all of those things forces us to confront denial, which makes it easier and easier just not to have those thoughts, no matter what disadvantage that leaves us at.
When that goes back to why people practice things that they're good at and they don't practice the things that they're bad at, because, well, that's not any fun.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, you can see denial in play at the range every day when people run a target out to 3 or 5 or 7 yards and make a wonderful tight grip with it round after round like a metronome. And if you ask them why they don't, you know, if they're particularly good at that, switch the gun to the other hand or shoot faster or something, they'll say, well, that would make the group open up. Well, that means they're more invested in the pride value of making that very compelling group that looks good to other shooters than they are in learning something that might be more applicable.
Right. Here's a question. So we were talking about people, you know, not being prepared to do the level of violence necessary maybe to successfully defend themselves. Do we ever see the opposite problem where if someone else gets involved, maybe we go too far too quickly because of the emotional attachment to the other person?
There are some cases like that, and they tend to be pretty narrowly distributed. You know, it is interesting to me that I do get the question fairly often, well, I'm a little worried that I'm a sociopath, and I'll say, well, what makes you think that? And they say, well, I really feel like I could hurt someone if the need arose. Well, the very fact that you have doubts about that means you're not a sociopath.
Yeah, yeah.
I tend to kind of have to assuage a lot of people about that. And I say the question itself proves that you fail that test.
Right.
But one thing where a sort of normal person can be pushed to pretty extreme behavior is involving loved ones, especially children.
Right.
There's, you know, it's not at all uncommon for people to go to pretty extreme lengths. There was a famous case down my neck of the woods in Louisiana in the late 70s, early 80s, when a martial arts instructor was accused of molesting young children and then took off on the lam only to be brought back to face the charges by the police. And as he was being transported through the Baton Rouge airport, the father of one of the alleged victims turned and concealed himself at a phone booth and executed the martial arts instructor with a pistol shot to the head as he walks by. The video is readily found on the internet.
Right.
Well, it turned out the martial arts instructor actually didn't commit the crime. And that's an example of other directed violence gone too far and an analytical process gone not far enough.
Well, and that's interesting because I had never heard that aspect to it where they found out that he hadn't done it.
That was the sort of end result was that they didn't feel like the accusations were substantiated. And who knows, innocence or guilt are, you know, very hard to prove in cases like that. But I think a lot of folks would endorse that with a sort of a, you know, armchair quarterback, hell yeah. But when you're talking about taking someone's life on the word of a child, well, children do lots of unusual things, including make stuff up.
Yeah.
And so when we think about, you know, you're writing a check, a blank check, up to and including your freedom and your life, the number of people we're willing to do unquestioned violence for should be absolutely minuscule.
Right. Well, and that once again goes back into the people's unwillingness to, you know, accept that a negative outcome might be the result of their action. We had a concealed carry instructor north of here just apprehend a robber. Now, they were within their legal rights to do so. You can effect a citizen's arrest in Ohio if you witness a felony occurring. You know, he held this guy at gunpoint, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people were saying, well, that's a great thing. And I'm over here like, well, the only reason that's a great thing is because in this instance, it didn't turn out that he had to shoot anyone, which would have been incredibly questionable, or he didn't get hurt himself. And it seems like just a lot of people are not thinking about the ways it can go wrong. They think about the ways it could go right, but they don't think about the ways it'll go wrong.
And those should be intention.
Right. I'm sorry. I talked too much, and I'll do better next time. But we have to go to break. Right now, we're talking with Dr. William April. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms, parts, and accessories. True Product Specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Barrett, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitor shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. And also, Eritus Industries and the Patent Pen and QDC, quick detach side saddle shell carrier, available now for pre-order. Would you like to know more? Desire to know more intensifies. Visit ErritusIndustries.com. Did you blow your nose behind me? Is that what that was?
I softly was like, because my desire to know more was intensifying.
I thought I excited you, and I'm like, uh-oh.
Shh. Just let it.
Yeah, let's focus now. Let's adult. So, we're talking with Dr. William April. You still there, buddy?
I sure am.
Excellent. I haven't hung up on you yet. That's good. It's always a plus. And see, now we're broadcasting this episode on a Google Hangout so people can see the video of what I do during the show. And now they'll understand why it's, like, really a concern of mine that I, you know, could hang up on you. Because I'm not paying as much attention to this as I should.
Well, also, John, all kidding aside, I want to thank you guys for taking the lead against the fight against Peyronie's disease.
No comment, because we're not allowed to, due to station policy, comment on the advertisements that play during the show. But yes, that's you can, because you've not signed any such thing. Anyway, moving forward.
Well, I guess you could always change the name of your show to the House of Bender.
Anyway, thank you. I'm so happy that you have gone down this path of information, you lovely person, you. Yeah, you just stay over there, Jack. So we were talking about before the break, people really shouldn't be willing to pretty much sign their life away for someone else, except in very minor, narrow circumstances. And certainly, you know, not without giving it a lot of forethought. Would you say that the biggest issue that we have when we're talking about these issues is people just don't make enough pre-need decisions?
Well, I think, yeah, exactly. But I think you've got to back up, you know, one order of magnitude and think about the difference between self-directed violence and other-directed violence. And the word violence itself makes people uncomfortable because we think violence is what the bad guys do, right? What I do as an armed citizen, well, that's defense. But when you're applying force to someone else's person, I mean, that is violence. And self-directed violence is the violence I'll do to save my own life. Other-directed violence is what I'll do to save the lives and protect the safety of others. For most folks, the threshold for other-directed violence is significantly lower than the threshold that that will trigger self-directed violence. So you'll see people save the lives of other people, then ignore that safety for themselves and re-engage. And that particular subset of other-directed violence in the name of or in defense of children, you know, that, like I said, that's a blank check that we're signing.
Right.
And so the cause can be very, very serious, our lives, our freedom, other people's lives. And yet it's almost unthought about in the future. I've just thought about globally, I'll do anything for my kids, unquote. Well, that's something we really have to think about, much more carefully now when we have the time, not at midnight on the corner of State and Maine.
Well, I mean, and that's certainly, you know, and I've been talking with you about it. Melody Lauer and I have been working on a curriculum for next year for the last 9 months now, I think, about pretty much defending your kids or what happens if something terrible occurs with your children present. And that's one of the major concerns, is not overreacting just because your kids are there.
Mm. No, that's an excellent point, because, like I said, there are very few things that can sort of have the average normal person go from, you know, zero to infinity instantly. But that's one of them. You know, the care people extend for their children is so extreme that the triggering is almost involuntary when it happens.
Right.
We've got to fight through that wave of almost blanking out. Rage isn't helpful to anyone.
So can you talk about the difference between a reaction versus a response?
Sure. You know, reactions by definition involuntary. I mean, when you throw sodium into water, that chemical reaction is instant. The sodium doesn't get to decide if it wants to explode. But almost all of our behavior should be responsive. There's an input. We're gonna process it using a cognitive process. We're going to think about it and then decide what to do. Now, that doesn't mean that's a slow endeavor, but that there's a cognitive interlude that changes it from a reaction to a response. And that's the behavior based on our thinking applied to the circumstance and not just a reaction or a reflex action.
So, I mean, how do we get over that? You know, there are trainers that say this is what will happen to us and we can't do anything about it, so we're just going to incorporate that into our training. And I've personally never agreed with that model, but I mean, to an extent, is that correct, or is it too dependent on the individual to make blanket statements?
Well, blanket statements are almost always false. Here, I'll make one. Blanket statements are always false, including that one.
Right.
But, you know, stress inoculation is the way, in that the world is never going to slow down. But if we're stress inoculated often enough, even through things like visualization, we can increase our processing speed. So that we can go through that process of receiving information from the world, cogitating on it, thinking about it, engaging our brains, and then taking the best action, but the best prompt action. I'm not posing that thinking should take the place of doing, but that instead thinking should be part of doing, as a part of reacting.
Well, so the key there being that, and I know you already touched upon it, but we need to do things that speed up our processing speed.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's something that we do now, not during the event. You know, as I always say, you're not going to develop new knowledge, skills, and attributes during the event.
Not any good ones.
No, it's a come as you are affair. But now we have almost unlimited power to think about the future, to allocate training resources and time and money and all that sort of thing, but especially to allocate headspace, to visualize and think about things that don't naturally occur to us, because the things that naturally occur to us can be very skewed. They can be skewed toward the things that we're good at, toward the things that we prefer to have happen. But what we want to do is strive to be able to see more of the world as it is, so that we're at or near that speed when the world manifests itself in a way that's harmful to us.
Well, and that's something that John Hearn talks about in his presentations is, you know, novel stimuli being one of the biggest issues that we face in these scenarios is that if it's something completely new to us, we waste valuable seconds or half seconds or whatever unit of time you want to use, you know, trying to catch up, and that can be deadly.
Exactly, and John's exactly right. You know, there is a, you know, people say there's no stopwatch in a gunfight. Well, there is. And as Tom Gibbons says, it's being held by the Grim Reaper.
Right.
Right? You have as much time as, you know, as there is and no more.
You've got the rest of your life
to solve this problem, right? Whether that's 70 years or 70 milliseconds, well, we're about to find out.
Right.
But having, you know, we can use the tendency of our mind to develop what we call like linkages. When we see things that are like something else, we can prepare by having as big a conceptualization of what might happen as possible. You know, think, sometimes it's a shattering change from sort of denial to new realization. Think about 9/11 and the use of box cutters to take over aircraft.
Right.
Well, that'll never work again.
No.
People's denial about that and the belief that you should hold on and wait for the negotiations to take place was shattered in a single day. And now, you know, God's mercy on the next person who tries to take over a plane with a box cutter. Because they're going to be attacked and dismembered by the folks on the plane who now realize that's the reality of the world. They've caught up to that.
Right.
So the more things we can think about, we can spread our schema, our sense of what we can conceive of beyond our experience and beyond our expectation if we do the legwork now before the crisis.
Well, and that's, you know, as individuals that are either in the training industry or, you know, on the outskirts of the training industry, it seems very self-serving for us to say things like that. But it is the absolute truth where, you know, like you said, in the middle of the problem is not when you start finding out ways to solve the problem if you've never considered it before.
Sure. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, you know, crisis doesn't create you know, character or knowledge, skills or attributes, it reveals them.
Right.
And what's revealed by the crisis may not be sufficient to handle the crisis.
Right. So let me interrupt there. Hold that thought. And I'm sorry for the whole commercial thing, but we got another one we got to get to. We're talking with Dr. William April right now. You're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Tac Strike Steel Target Systems, maker to the quarter scale steel target and the airframe target stand, which are literally the best steel targets and target stands I've ever used. Hit their steel targets with more than 60,000 rounds of rifle, pistol, and shotgun ammunition without a single problem. For more information, visit them at TacStrike.com. And also, Aridus Industries and the patent-pending QDC Quick Detach Side Saddle Shell Carrier. Available now for pre-order. Check out the new rigid interchangeable side saddle carrier, changing how you look at shotguns forever. Find out why Steve Fisher, Chris Fry, and myself all call it the best hard mount side saddle carrier ever invented. Would you like to know more? Visit AridusIndustries.com. And we are talking with Dr. William April. William, are you still there?
I sure am.
Excellent. So we've kind of discussed, you know, violence and the levels of violence necessary and who we will commit that violence for. I kind of want to switch gears just a little bit, and then actually I want to talk about a class that we're bringing up to Alliance at the beginning, mid part of December. I guess more towards the end of December, really.
I think that's mid-December.
Is it mid-December?
It's yeah, I could be wrong, but yeah, it's mid-December, I think.
Was that a meow? Did you just throw a meow at me?
No.
Oh, it sounded like a Super Troopers reference, and in which case...
Why would I make a Super Troopers reference right meow?
I don't know why you'd do that right meow. So what I wanted to ask you about... I'm sorry, William, but they really shouldn't let us have a radio show. I don't know why they let us, but what I wanted to ask you about is, as far as indecision goes, when we are taking actions, there seems to be... You know, you teach a block on weapons disarmament, weapons disarms, whatever. Anyway, and this sort of applies to the classic hostage rescue scenario. Can you talk a little bit about the need for decisive action when we choose to act, and what some of the downfalls are if we don't?
Well, I think the longer you generally wait, once you've determined the best course of action, right, it just becomes a matter of pure internal inhibition. We're thinking of all the things that can go wrong instead of all the things that drive us toward action. If a dangerous action can be avoided, then of course it should. But, you know, as I always say at the start of every disarming and retention class, the only reason we would attempt to disarm, which is from a position of pretty maximal disadvantage, is because the alternative is worse. We've come to believe that even if we were to comply with a robber, say, we're going to be executed. And so at that point, it's a matter of not thinking about if I'll undertake a disarm, but when and how. But that process starts us down another, what can be kind of a curly trail of decision-making, where once we've decided to do something but get lost in thinking about how to do it, the downsides get larger and larger in consideration, and we tend to do nothing by default, not by choice. So generally, if you determine what the right course of action is, the time to do it is as soon as it's practicable.
Well, and that's, you know, I know that's a very vague sort of thing for us to try and talk about, and it's very hard to make absolute statements about situations that we're not immediately involved in, but
right.
Go ahead.
You know, there is a kind of an interesting take on the standard sort of hostage rescue target, and how that target, which is, you know, typically someone being held loosely around the neck in a sort of a chokehold format by someone who's been holding a pistol to their temple, you know, that has become what defines the hostage rescue shot in just about everyone's minds. The late trainer Paul Gomez used to actually test it against the clock and found that more people were able to physically run the distance and make a contact shot to the hostage taker, unquote, head, then we're able to hit it from 5 or 7 yards in the same time frame. So that target has, I think, gone a long way towards shaping people's conception of what a hostage situation is going to be in a way that's very unfortunate, I think.
Well, and that's one of the things that actually we were out with Chuck Haggard, the legendary lawman, Marshal Chuck Haggard, you know, and one of the things that we were working on was hostage shots, hostage rescue shots. And that was something that he was really talking about, was being able to project the muzzle past the loved one or no shooter, whatever you want to call it, and making essentially a contact shot because it's a much more sure thing.
Certainly. And the time window we're talking about is not very much. I mean, you know, I can remember being with Paul Gomez when he was actually timing it out on a timer. Had people run evolutions, and how quickly could they run 3 yards, 5 yards, 7 yards, and make a contact range headshot, basically sort of a straight punch as close as they could get to the hostage taker's forehead and press the trigger. And it was certainly no slower than the amount of time it took to make a shot that accurate at that distance under pressure. And, you know, the target itself being stationary, I think, skews people's ideas of what's possible. You know, when guns are out, most people are moving, and yet those targets are almost always static.
Well, and the other thing, too, that not enough people think about is, and once again, I'll give credit where credit's due. Chuck was talking about this with us. When you advance on someone that's taken a hostage or in general that is acting that way, number one, they're not expecting it. Number two, whether they mean to or not, it tends to divert the muzzle away from the hostage. You know,
no,
they,
I would certainly yield to Chuck's expertise on that. You know, he's done a lot of, I think, very high order thinking about that sort of circumstance.
Right. Well, and I know that, you know, he's run quite a few force on force exercise numbered in the thousands, where they've done scenarios just like that. And, you know, it's a natural response when we're attacked, even if we are the bad guy, to point the thing that makes the problem go away at the problem, you know.
Right. So. Yeah, I think it sets up some tension in the thinking process of the hostage taker, because shooting the hostage doesn't make the hostage taker any safer from assault.
Right.
If a rescuer a loved one or any other kind of rescuer has initiated a rescue attempt, shooting the hostage doesn't solve that problem for the hostage taker.
Right.
I think the thinking about hostage scenarios in and of itself has got to, it is certainly about due for an upgrade.
Well, I know there was a recent article published, and I apologize. I can't remember the counterpoint, the author of the counterpoint, but Claude Werner was talking about the necessity of marksmanship and how, yes, the hostage targets were suboptimal, but that there were countless examples of it actually working out in real life where, number one, there was a hostage taken, and number two, a private citizen, not a cop, not a SWAT member, not a high-speed guy, actually shot someone off of someone else.
Sure.
Not enough people think about it. So once again, that falls into one of the scenarios, though, that it's very hard to think about and people don't want to.
Exactly. And, I think Claude's point is well taken in that it's a marksmanship problem, but it's every bit as much and maybe even more a thinking problem.
Right.
And to think about it in advance, it is not going to be effort that's wasted. One of the rescue shots that he mentions in his article was taken at slightly more than 20 yards, if I recall, from a second story of a private residence.
Right.
And so it seems that people are able to do it as long as they haven't been told that they can't.
Well, and that's an interesting thing. It seems to me that if we tell people that they will perform to a low level, and that's what we expect from them, then they will perform at a low level. Whereas if we tell people that they will perform at a high level if they train adequately, and then that's the level we hold them accountable to, they seem to do all right.
Sure. It's a quote that's often attributed to Henry Ford, but I think it's perfectly applicable. Whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right. And so the notion of that we're going to tell someone, you can't do this, it's incredibly dangerous and it never works, and then say, now go do it, and someone's life is on the line.
Right.
It's remarkably bad counter-programming.
Right. Well, so let's do this, man. We're coming up on the end of the show. I would like to talk about the Unthinkable class that you and Paul Sharp are putting on December 19th and 20th in Alliance, Ohio. Tell us about that a little bit.
Oh, really looking forward to it. It's going to be two... very, very full training days. Paul is working on a special curriculum that I am sworn to secrecy about, but I can tell you that it's going to be about a lot of the realistic parts of shooting in challenging environments, in the challenging winter environment. And luckily, you guys are going to provide us a challenging winter environment, I hope, on the 20th of December.
Yep.
And so there'll be, obviously we'll take all the precautions to make sure that nobody's going to get injured or sick from being in the cold, but we're going to deal with the realities of shooting in cold weather and cold weather gear very directly and see how it affects just about all the shooting. There'll be some really intensive training on victim selection process and how to get yourself deselected by violent street criminals. We're going to talk about facing a pistol when you are yourself not having one in your hand and disarming and retention. And we're going to talk about constructing a really effective defensive mindset starting at the time when we have the most power to affect the outcome. Talking about that pre-need decision process that you mentioned earlier. So it's going to be a very full 2 days, and 2 days that I'm looking quite forward to.
Well, yeah, and it's going to be at the Alliance Police Training Facility, which I really believe is quickly becoming the premier facility in the country. It's certainly one of the nicest places I've ever gotten to shoot at, and that's saying a lot.
And it may sound strange from an instructor's point of view, but I'm dying to see the place myself. It sounds fantastic.
Yes, it will be super cool. If people want to get signed up for that, there is information on the Ballistic Radio Facebook page. We've actually created an event. The class is a little more than half full right now. I think we're at like 70% of capacity. So if you want to get signed up, it's $375, which for two national-level trainers for 2 days of instruction is an incredible, incredible deal. And the range fee is only $25. So it's a, it's going to be a super cool time, but, hey, we're at the end of the show, William. I appreciate you coming on tonight, man. Sorry for the delay at the beginning.
Not at all. Thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Oh yeah, no worries. And I'm looking forward to seeing you December 19th and 20th. So
you, absolutely.
You be safe, brother.
Great. I will.
All righty. See ya. So, make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Don't know who we're having on next week, but I'm sure it'll be someone cool. It usually is. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.